This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 97 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
I'm good, David. Hey, just real quickly, I wanted to mention something. I was on the radio talking drones. I actually appeared on KSFR Radio. That's the Santa Fe public radio station with longtime journalism pro Dave Marish. His show is Here and There, and we talked for an hour about drones and regulations and privacy and all kinds of issues. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes if you're interested in listening to me and Dave Marish. But it was a lot of fun. It was pretty cool.
You know, I did listen, believe it or not. I don't know if I'm happy about you running around cheating talking about drones with another Dave, but it was really well done. Looked like you had a little bit of problem with your Skype connection, but no, it was good, you know, and got to get the word out of our tiny little show, and it just shows folks what kind of person Max has become. He's grown into this multimedia god, you know, he's showing multiple shows, multiple networks, you know, and now he's broadening out to radio. So, well done, Max. But thank we got it. We got our own little show to talk about, don't we?
Yes, we do. We have a great lineup today.
We've got a guest.
Yes, our guest this episode is Jonathan Ruprecht. He's a drone lawyer. Jonathan formed his own law firm, Ruprecht Law, in December 2014, and he's providing legal services for operators of unmanned aerial vehicles. Jonathan's also authored a book on the law in the United States pertaining to unmanned aircraft, and it's called Drones, Their Many Civilian Uses and the U.S. Laws Surrounding Them. Jonathan's also one of the advisors for the amicus briefs for the Huerta v. Perker case. But Jonathan's also a commercial pilot. He's got single and multi-engine aircraft ratings. He's also a flight instructor. He obtained his Bachelor of Science in Professional Aeronautics from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and his law degree from Florida International University School of Law. So, Jonathan, we want to welcome you to the UAV Digest.
Thank you so much for having me.
David, we've been talking about law and drones and the intersection of those two areas. So I think it's really fantastic that we've got Jonathan on the show and he can tell us a lot about lawyering in this new era of drones.
All right. And I won't use my favorite Shakespeare passage in honor of our guest tonight. Max, you and I have both said that we didn't realize how much we would be learning about the legal system as we have over the last 2 years that we've been doing this. So again, Jonathan, thank you. And I think we'll scatter in some news also, just to give people a heads up. Nest and Verizon have a UAS tracking system. The Google Internet HALE, which we know HALE stands for High Altitude Long Endurance Drone, crashes on its first flight. And Boeing patented a drone charging concept. But most of all, we're here to talk about the law. John, where do you think we are right now with the law? Is it fairly new? Is it starting to become crystal clear? Or is it all hands on deck and people are just throwing things out in the water to see what sticks?
Drone law is really just kind of aviation law with kind of slightly morphed. And so you're having a square getting pounded into a round hole. And at this point, we've pretty much hit that square block enough times that that edge is kind of starting to come off and that it's starting to go through the round hole. We kind of are starting to develop an idea of commercial drone operations for right now. So with the Section 333 process, or if you want to go the special air within a certificate route in the restricted category, you can go those routes. If you're a public aircraft operator, you could then also go and get a COA to do operations for search and rescue, military. Firefighting, those type of things. So it has started coming together much more clearly, especially within the last 6 months. I mean, with the NPRM coming out, we have a fairly good indication of where the FAA is at least trying to head. However, I don't know exactly what that's going to end up like at the very end. So, for instance, ALPA and AOPA, Airlines Pilots Association and Aircraft Owners Pilots Association, is going to be probably lobbying to add on more restrictions to the NPRM. So we at least know probably what the floor is, and it could get a little bit more burdensome, but we kind of have a fairly good indication now compared to where we were a year ago.
It's kind of tricky in a way, Jonathan, I think, because it's not even a moving target. It's a target that really hasn't settled much at all. I mean, you mentioned the NPRM, and so, yeah, that gave us an excellent, excellent view of how the FAA is viewing the regulations that we may end up with, but you know how much they'll change. We just don't know. It's kind of difficult to navigate through waters like that, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, yeah. There's going to be some issues there. Also, what is not in the NPRM is like beyond visual line of sight operations, night operations, overcrowd stadium type of operations. Those haven't really even been that much addressed. I know that beyond visual line of sight has recently opened up and they're going to start testing in those areas, but that's a whole nother mess of problems that are definitely going to come down the pike. It's similar to when you go and get your private pilot's license. You kind of learn, oh, this is what we have to do with the sectional and, you know, the pattern and all of that. But then once you go in instrument training, it's pretty much like you're starting at square one all over again with your flying under the hood and all the rules. And now you have the IFR chart. So it's going to be the same thing with beyond visual line of sight. It's like, well, we just entered into a new realm of where no man has gone before, you know, Star Trek reference. So we're going to have to start figuring that out, especially with FCC issues. So, you know, we're going to have to what type of frequency spectrum are we going to really open up for these really long distance flights? And what type of integrity is the navigation system going to have? Can we just go strictly upon GPS? And could we also use LORAN in addition to the GPS to maintain an integrity? Maybe similar to, you know, LORAN using it with the instrument aircraft with a WAS or a LOS or something to provide that like kind of that third party integrity monitoring. So there's issues there that are going on, you know, and also exporting drones. There's problems there. Because the United States does a lot of intellectual property with drones. And so you're exporting those ideas to China. You could potentially get in issues there. Sure. Also, when you are building, I mean, you're building them and then sending them back here to the U.S. Well, then what happens when you want to distribute them to another country? Let's say you want to go to Iran, or, you know, you want to send your little Phantom 2 to Iran or North Korea. You know, are there potential issues there? You know, there's a lot of issues. And then now that we somewhat have the FAA square block pounded through, it's starting to get rounded off. There's still some, you know, 90 degree angles, but you have the states and the local government starting to get into this area and starting to regulate. And that's causing more and more problems. So, I mean, you have the federal jurisdiction, you have your state jurisdiction, right, your county jurisdiction, and sometimes your town or city jurisdiction. So for right now where I live, I have the FAA telling me what to do. I have the state also telling me what to do. I have my county telling me what to do. And I have my town telling me what to do. I have four levels. And so I can't just look at only the FAA. I have other three areas to look to and making sure that I'm in compliance. And so these are some other issues that are, you know, playing around with right now, especially federalism. You have the 10th Amendment and federalism, states' rights, preemption, all mixed into one. This one issue coming up here of what happens when the FAA says you're good to go with your 333 and your commercial pilot's license, your registered drone, go make money. And then the state says, nope, you can't do that. What happens then? What happens when I get fined or arrested? Then what happens when I go to court? Well, that's a whole issue that hasn't been fully decided. And so somebody's going to have to be the test case for that.
So, John, with all of these issues, the kinds of things that you just mentioned, what do lawyers bring to the party? What role do lawyers play in all of this?
I would say the one that I've run into the most is helping individuals actually figure out the best business plan in regards to what type of operations they want to do. So, for instance, I had a guy call me up. He was wanting to do some 333 work, and after chatting with him for a little while, trying to figure out, you know, nailing down exactly what he wants to do, he couldn't do anything under the 333. So I'm like, well, it's kind of good that you know that now, as opposed to getting into it and buying a bunch of drones and trying to set up a company to figure out, well, your original plan is totally not allowed under the 333s at the moment. Now, we could try to petition the FAA to allow those type of operations, but that's going to cost some time and money, you know, to figure that out, because it's never been done before.
What made you decide you wanted to get involved with it? Is it just it's just so wide open, or was there something specific you wanted to focus on?
Well, at the moment, I'm focusing on the commercial operations with the Section 333. I am interested in starting to branch out into the EAR, FCC areas. I'm interested in those. Also, just dealing with state of Florida issues. I know that I'm on the Florida Department of Agriculture's working group on unmanned aircraft, and we were dealing with a recently passed law here in the state of Florida that actually gave individuals that were filmed on their own private property a private right of action to sue individuals that were filming them from a drone. And so that creates some problems. I was not the author of that, and so I was not the one a proponent of that, but it – there are laws out there that are starting to come down the pike, and I would love to get involved with individuals, you know, trying to help them out, because this is a serious – some of these individuals in government are having a knee-jerk reaction, and it's like, quickly, let's ban them because I don't understand it, and we're going to have a phantom prying in people's – you know, looking into people's windows and eavesdropping and being a pervert. And they don't really understand that a lot of these fears that they have can already be resolved with laws that are already in place. You can sue individuals who are peering into your house. You know, they're peeping Toms. They're perverts. You can go after them, and they can be criminally charged. You can go after them civilly. So
– yeah, you don't need a separate drone law to cover that necessarily, because like you say, it's already covered in many cases under the laws that are already on the books.
Right, exactly. And so you're having an over-breath problem where you're trying to solve all these issues, and you end up taking out other you unintentionally are taking out other other areas. So, for instance, here in Florida, if you were a government entity that has some type of law enforcement powers, okay, you're actually precluded from using unmanned aircraft unless you fall under certain exemptions. And so what one of the issues there is, well, you can also get a warrant, but one of the issues there is for like fish and wildlife. Like, why in the world are they precluded from doing that? However, they do have a law enforcement arm to them, so they can't use drones as easily as we could unless they fall under exceptions or get a warrant. So there's unintended consequences when you do these knee-jerk reactions. And I think for individuals desiring to pass laws, I would just say, chill out, hold on, like, let's start analyzing these issues better. Are the remedies already in place? We don't really need to reinvent the wheel here.
Yeah, that's something that we've been talking about for a while. And I'm glad to hear you take that position as well. Because you worked on the Huerta v. Perker case, I just wanted to ask, as we all know, ultimately that was settled. I mean, it went through the administrative law judge with the NTSB, then it was reviewed by the board, sent back to the judge, and sort of settled. Did you find that to be kind of unfortunate from the standpoint of it not flowing through the legal system completely in order to really firmly establish some case law here, or was it okay the way it turned out?
Well, I just want to clarify that I didn't actually work on the amicus brief, like with as the dealing with Perker as Brendan Shulman did. I was assisting on an amicus brief that was filed in support of Perker at the NTSB level. So I was working with another attorney on that, just to clarify.
Thank you.
I wish that actually went up, and we would have that Perker and Shulman would have fought that more. Two real good issues there is one, jurisdiction of the FAA. They have jurisdiction over navigable airspace. How far down does navigable airspace actually go? So with Perker flying below the buildings, is that considered navigable airspace? When does a helicopter ever fly down below that area? And so I understand some people think that Perker was flying recklessly. Let's just say he was. Now, does that mean FAA has jurisdiction there? Or could also the University of Virginia have called the cops and he could have been arrested and prosecuted for flying recklessly? That's a jurisdictional argument. And when he went up higher, let's say he went up above 400 or 500 feet, and he's definitely in navigable airspace. How is it careless and reckless that he was flying first-person viewing 500 feet above in navigable airspace? How is that careless and reckless? So we have a whole jurisdictional issue there, and they need to prove careless and recklessness because – and then how do they get jurisdiction over him in addition to just location-wise? I mean, he's a non-U.S. citizen with no pilot's license and an unregistered aircraft with no airworthiness certificate. There's like – how do you get your fingers on him to say, oh, we have control over him? Because pilots, they can be prosecuted for violating the federal aviation regulations below navigable airspace. If I recklessly taxi – my airplane down the runway, the FAA can get upset with that and come after my pilot certificate. So, you know, how did the FAA get a hold of that? And then furthermore, even if this went up to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals,
right,
the FAA has kind of a longstanding interpretation of model aircraft and aircraft, if you will, because they never really fully addressed that, that these model aircraft have been pretty much ignored and not really regulated for how many years. And under, I believe, the Alaskan fisherman case, I mean, the Alaskan bush pilots case, I would say, well, you have a longstanding interpretation here. You guys should have gone the notice and comment route. The whole idea of notice and comment is to give people an idea of what's coming down the pike so they can properly prepare themselves, not just a quick knee-jerk reaction. Let's just publish something in the Federal Register back like in 2007. Oh, commercial operations, you have to go the special airworthiness certificate route. The whole idea of notice and comment is to inform the public, give them an opportunity to comment. Is this the best thing or not? The FAA didn't go that route, and I think they should have. And if it went up to a D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, you might have been able to argue argue that this should have gone the notice, you know, proposed rule, a notice and comment route, and that this should just shouldn't be enforceable. It's just a policy statement.
Interesting.
So, Jonathan, now that you've talked about it through a lawyer standpoint, what does the pilot in you think? You know, you have the interesting aspect that you're a commercial pilot. You have your certificate, right? And you know what AOPA and all of our pilot friends, a lot of them, think about UAVs and interfering in their airspace. So how do you find the balance between the pilot in you and the drone lover in you?
I say that drones and airplanes are we shouldn't face them off like that. It really, what we should try to face it off as is, it's the non-professional people that are reckless and careless versus the professionals. Okay, the professionals want to fly airplanes or drones, and they don't have any desire to do something stupid with their aircraft and endanger people or their aircraft. And so you can there's individuals flying their drones right now commercially. They don't want to risk flying their, you know, $20,000 rig with a $50,000 red Epic on it. That why would they do that? But however, you have some young 20-something-year-old guy that just bought a Phantom off of Amazon, and what is he doing? He's flying around. Oh, how cool it is. Oh, wow, let me go really, really high, and how close can I get to that aircraft? Those are the individuals I'm actually upset with. And what actually bugs me further is that in the FMRA, the FAA is actually their hands are tied from promulgating rules in regards to regulating hobbyists. I actually think the uneducated, reckless hobbyists are the ones giving everybody a bad name. And I think that's actually who we should be targeting. Everybody is just targeting the uneducated, reckless people that are flying drones, even manned drones too. I mean, and the manned aircraft as well, flying 152s, 172s. They're on both camps. It's just not one. Both sides have problems.
Yeah, but how would you recommend doing that? Here in Philadelphia last weekend or a weekend or so ago, we actually had a guy that from the parking lot of our Citizens Bank Park baseball stadium proceeded to fly a DJI, a Phantom, up into the stadium in the middle of the game and over third base. you know, luckily he was caught. We'll see if the FAA does anything. But from a legal standpoint, how do we go about educating the general public? You know, do we make the fine so force that it kills the hobby, or
no? I think the Know Before You Fly campaign with putting the pamphlets in the with the fandoms and on the DJI products, I think that was a great step. I think this whole NPRM thing, we're it's part of the rulemaking process, I understand, but I think it would also make a lot of sense for the FAA to immediately implement some type of online based kind of educational campaign, or some type of even if they want to go so far as to maybe argue that it, under an emergency rule granting powers, they can implement a situation, you know, a website where individuals could go on there and they could take a test and get some license or something. I know that's some individuals might not want that, but I think it would at least put a stop to these individuals who are completely uneducated. I think we need to just completely saturate the area with education as much as possible. So every drone that is sold should have some type of sticker, some type of pamphlet saying, you know, here, this is what is available. I wouldn't require it, but I would at least make everyone available so much so that there's really no excuse for when they do not comply with those laws that they can't say, I didn't know.
John, before we run out of time, I want to make sure to mention the book that you wrote. Tell us a little bit about the motivation for writing that and what people can find in this book.
Yes, I actually started working on the draft to that book back in mid 2013, and it was when I did some research on the Japanese integration to the U.S. integration. And from the U.S. side of things, I kind of let the book blossom some more and put some more research into it and then published that book. And I have since updated it a few times since it was originally published over a year ago. So it's, I believe, updated as of February. And this book is great for recreational flyers wanting to know what the FAA has said, and the FAA has not been completely consistent at what they said everywhere. So you have the 2014 model rule, you know, 9157, Know Before You Fly campaign that they were kind of endorsing. So I took all of those and put them in a chart, like a table in the back that lists everything that they've ever said with a citation to it. If you're an investor wanting to know more about the area, this would be a great thing to do when you're the clients, people you're willing to invest in are coming to you and telling you stuff. You can at least check on what they're having to say, that they're not pulling the wool over your eyes. If you're a business that's supporting the industry or kind of in a related field, like if you're a camera maker, like Red, for instance, or Canon, Panasonic, that's making cameras, I would say that you need to know this so you know the verbiage, the terminology, what's going on. Or if you're outside the country wanting to know what's going on inside the U.S.
Now, you're also working on a book for the American Bar Association.
Yes, that book has actually been, I've completed my portion of actually drafting it. I did two chapters. There was the history of unmanned aircraft, where I kind of went back way back when, and I mean, the first unmanned aircraft attack was back in like 1840s, I believe. And I kind of traced it up over time, how it's evolved. And in the second chapter, I did it on the FAA rulemaking process. And I was specifically focusing on the NPRM and the many, many hoops that they have to go through. And so some individuals think this whole thing is going to take, you know, maybe a year or less. And I really would think it's going to probably take 2 or 3 years just based upon the research that I've done.
Interesting. All right. Well, John, fascinating conversation. There are certainly many, many other things that we could talk to you about. And maybe we'll have to have you back on the show again sometime in the near future.
I'd love to be back on.
David, we've got a couple of news items. Maybe it's possible to get through these really fast, and maybe the fastest news segment we've had. What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. Evidently, NASA's working with Verizon, and that you can find that story in theguardian.com, links in the show notes. We could talk about Google's Titan Aerospace, which we talked about them buying about a year ago. Well, their aircraft designed to fly at 65,000 feet with a 50-foot wingspan, all covered with solar cells, unfortunately broke on takeoff and crashed. We have the NTSB, our friends at the NTSB, investigating. And I think we'll save the last Boeing story for our next week's show.
Oh, let's do it this week because it talks about intellectual property, and we could ask John if he knows anything about that.
Okay, this is Boeing patent system for airborne drone charging. Boeing's patent titled, quote, autonomous aircraft with disconnectable tether, describes the systems where drones drops tethers to ground-based charging stations. Kind of frightening, actually.
Well, interesting concept, but maybe it's sort of the broader topic here, and John, you can maybe weigh in on this, is that we're starting to see companies file patents for all kinds of things related to drones. I don't know what your intellectual property background is from a legal standpoint, if any, but it's kind of like the Wild West, isn't it? It's kind of like companies maybe are going to start filing patents for any kind of technology or any kind of method that they can dream up of, and you know, maybe it'll someday be a reality, someday it won't.
Right, exactly. I mean, but if they have the patent to it, then they can at least use it, as opposed to one of their competitors filing a patent from, you know, and because you're going to have potential patent litigation that can come down the bike here.
Yeah.
So if Facebook, for instance, wants to start dabbling in something similar to what Google's wanting to do, then Google can try to file a suit against them saying that it's patent infringement. So I see these larger companies like Amazon just recently did their their patent, I believe, was awarded. So they're going to start gobbling up these ideas and start filing patents on them. And I see that there could be some interesting lawsuits ahead between those large companies for patent infringements.
Yeah, especially in the United States, this could get kind of messy because of our patent system.
Well, it's kind of funny. I highly recommend, if you have National Geographic Network, they've got American Inventors, I think it's called, and I'll put a link in the show notes. But they did an episode on the Wrights versus Glenn Curtiss.
Hmm.
And most of the episode talks about the Wrights patent for the wing warping and basically the design of the airplane. And Glenn Curtiss's solution was given to him by Henry Ford, who had sort of the same problem. Glenn Curtiss kept changing his design and submitting a new patent. And every time he did, the Wrights had to defend that against new claim.
Mm.
And basically they got overwhelmed and eventually lost. They spent more time filing lawsuits than they did designing aircraft. it was a really fascinating story. I highly recommend it. But I guess, John, what do you think is the biggest black hole, or where do you think the biggest legal challenges are going to come? Is it going to be privacy? Is it going to be FAA regulation? Or is there something that we haven't yet seen that might be lurking out there that will require lots and lots of lawyers?
I don't think we're going to have too many of the privacy issues, because that's going to eventually, the drones are going to start assimilating into society much more. I mean, they're going to start becoming pretty ubiquitous. FAA is eventually going to publish the final rules and start adding on more and more. And I don't see too much of an issue there. You can have some issues with criminal issues, with people trying to use them criminally. I think it's going to be kind of like a technological arms race where individuals will start using drones for nefarious purposes, and they'll have to create countermeasures. And countermeasures are going to have to start getting developed, and they have never really been thought about before. So, for instance, you want to start developing a drone jamming device to protect certain locations. Well, what type of FCC hoops do you have to jump through? So you're kind of, I wouldn't say, you're trying to figure out how to round off those edges on the square to get into these round holes all over the regulatory area for FCC, ITAR, EAR, FAA. That's going to be everywhere. You're just trying to assimilate drones in legally in all the aspects of our life. I think those are going to be the problems.
All right. Well, David, we've got a video of the week.
We do. And this was, of course, sent in by one of our listeners.
This comes from Heath, I think.
It comes from Heath, yes. And Heath writes, "Hey, guys, I've been listening to the show for a couple of months, and I really love the show. I thought I'd share with you a video of the week. Our area had an enormous amount of rain lately, and many areas are flooded. And this is from Shreveport, Louisiana. It's pretty interesting. It's a lot of flood damage, but it's very artistic. And part two is more about the human drama that's involved. And it does definitely lean itself towards the why we need UAVs for search and rescue, especially with all the flooding that we've had recently in the area."
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. We received some feedback from some of you. We had several of you, including Dan and Paul, sent in links about this issue with Enrique Iglesias, who had a drone accident during one of his performances, apparently.
No, drone stupidity, not a drone accident.
Yeah, I think so. I think as part of the act, the idea was that he would catch the drone, which had a camera on it, turn it around and film the audience. But in the act of catching it, he
caught a rotor,
injured his hand. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Also, we heard from Jeff. He sent in a link to this outfit called Extreme Sandbox. And I guess this is an outfit in Hastings, Minnesota. And they've opened an attraction they call RC Adventure. But one of the things you can do is basically rent DJI Phantom 2s, run them on an obstacle course. And I think that's kind of a very unique thing. I don't know of anybody else that would let you rent a drone.
As well as it's a confined, sort of well-administered, we hope, way for people who want to get the experience to go do it before they go out and buy one and then fly into an airplane.
Right.
And I think as an industry, we've got to, and I've been thinking about this over the last couple of days, over the weeks, how do we constructively get people to fly their drones and get the enjoyment out of it? But give them a structure that they can, a place for them to fly, a place where they can fly safely, a place where they can learn. We need the Academy of Model Aeronautics for drones, but I really think that we need to get some sort of something out there. And I want to start looking for new and positive ways for people to fly drones in more of a constructive way, you know, and get the enjoyment of doing all the videography and such, but in a safe environment. What do you think, John?
I totally agree.
All right. Well, very good. I think we need to wrap this one up. This has been episode 97 of the UAV Digest. We want to thank you all for listening. You can find us at theuavdigest.com. And if you'd like to go straight to the show notes, just go to theuavdigest.com/97. We want to thank our guest, John Ruprecht. John, tell our audience where they can find you online.
Yes, they can find me online at my website at www.jruprechtlaw.com. And it's spelled JRUPPRECHTLAW.com.
Very good. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, of course. And as for the book, is Amazon the best place to find that?
Yes.
Okay. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. So, David, where can folks find us on the usual social media spots?
On Twitter, at UAV Digest. Facebook, join our Facebook community, which is /UAV Digest. And, of course, you can send us feedback, and that's feedback@theuavdigest.com. And, guys, we read them, we do, and if we're a little slow getting to you responding, we do eventually respond to you, but definitely keep them coming. Of course, you can leave us feedback on iTunes. That way, more people can find us, or on Stitcher.com. We have a Patreon account, and I'd like to thank Joel, who is our newest patron, donating to us. And that helps us fund the little show. I mean, while we're not trying to make millions of dollars on this, folks, it does pay for things like servers and hosting and microphones and the little things that most people don't realize we need to get this going. No, we're not going out and buying our own DJI Phantoms using it. We're still hoping that they want to just donate them to us. But last, you can get some swag at our Cafe Press store. So if you'd like to do either of those two, go to our website, which is the UAVDigest.com, and click the links. And again, I think we'd like to thank our guest, John. I know we've been corresponding back and forth for a couple of months, and appreciate you coming on, and hopefully you'll come back with some more news. I'd like to hear some more about what happens with you and the Florida agriculture, because that's a big business. So again, John, thank you. And with that, I guess I'd like to say it's David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.